So it may be the broken heart that saves our ass right now. It may be that grief is the one thing that can penetrate deep enough to remind us that we are grieving because of love.
Welcome to the Little Gifts Podcast. This is Sue Ellen Parkinson.
And I'm her granddaughter, Savannah Wonderwheel. And we're on a journey together to find deeper meaning and magic in the day-to-day.
We're so happy to have you join us.
Morning, Grandma.
Good morning, Savannah. I am so excited about our guest today. Our guest is Frances Weller, an old friend and someone who I have a great deal of respect for. His heart wisdom has saved me personally on several occasions. I don't know if you know that, Frances, but it's true. And Savannah, you've got some bio information about him, I think.
I do, yeah. And Frances, your name has come up on other episodes a couple times now. So I think this is going to be a really good one just to tie that all together. So for all our listeners who maybe don't know who Frances Weller is, he is a psychotherapist, writer, and soul activist. For over 40 years, Frances has worked as a psychotherapist and developed a style he calls soul-centered psychotherapy. He is the author of The Wild Edge of Sorrow, Rituals of Renewal, and The Sacred Work of Grief that was very, very highly recommended and talked about during our episode with Kayleen. He's also written The Threshold Between Loss and Revelation with Rishani Rea, and In the Absence of the Ordinary, Essays in a Time of Uncertainty. He's currently completing his fourth book, Facing the World with Soul and Why It Matters. Frances has introduced the healing work of ritual to thousands of people, Grandma Sue being included in that, and myself as well. Frances is also the founder and director of Wisdom Bridge, an organization that offers educational programs that seek to integrate the wisdom from Indigenous cultures with the insights and knowledge gathered from Western poetic, psychological, and spiritual traditions. And we just cannot be more thrilled to have you on. And I also have to say that you are the first man to join us on our show. So that also feels like a bit of an accolade.
I'm very honored.
You know, I was thinking about that, Frances, and I think it's no accident that we've had a man on who's actually worked with his grief, metabolizes his grief, and talks about grief, because the men who don't are pretty scary.
This is true. When we don't work with the sorrows in the heart tends to turn bitter, and bitterness metastasizes into violence, and that's a lot of what we're seeing right now. Yeah. So thank you for having me. I'm delighted to be here. Delighted to see both of you. I haven't seen you for many, many years. Savannah, you were saying like 14 years ago, maybe?
So, yeah, I think last time I saw you was at one of the gratitude ritual weekends, and I think I was 16, would be my guess, the last time I was in space with you. So I was saying before we started recording, just for the listeners, that I feel like sitting here seeing Grandma and you, Frances, both next to me, I keep having little flashbacks to feeling like a 11-year-old sitting in circles with the two of you. Very sweet.
Yeah, it is very sweet.
Well, we were all part of, Frances had this vision of having ritual village training. I don't know if you want to talk about that, Frances, a little bit. And that's how we actually met about 20 years ago.
Right. Well, the idea was, you know, that we needed to kind of recapitulate or reimagine the original matrix of what human beings developed as a means of not only survival, but also of cultivating the richest and most robust psychological, soulful life we could. And that was all communal. Every element of our lives were communal, our grief, our celebrations, our meals. And suddenly we were thrown into this ideology of individualism. Mm-hmm. And the consequence of that has been dire. What was once a full and intertwined life between the individual, the community, and the culture and the world has now become a very singular experience of me. And the ensuing emptiness that comes with that has been devastating to the planet, in part because we've been trying to fill that emptiness with stuff, power, wealth, material goods, and you can never satisfy that hunger. The only thing that satisfies that hunger is that sense of being a part of something larger than your own individual life. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of the vision behind creating these ritual trainings.
Yeah, you talk about essential satisfactions and the lack of thereof. And I don't know if you want to describe those essential satisfactions a little bit, because I know that was what I was longing for, which is what drew me to that group, that and doing mm-hmm. my daughter.
Yeah. Primary satisfactions is what
primary.
I call it. Yeah.
Yes.
That over our 300,000 year evolution as a species, certain patterns emerged that were conducive to that sense of contentment and also evoking out of each of us some larger identity. And so those primary satisfactions were the things that allowed the psyche to, in a sense, relax into being. So if those satisfactions were met, like I mentioned, like knowing that when there was trouble, the community would gather. When there was loss, we would grieve together. When there was reasons for giving gratitude, we would do that together. We would share meals. We would sing together. You know, we would tell stories. We would create art together. We would gather the food. Every part of the elemental life was entwined in communal value. And so those primary satisfactions are the things that we long for the most now, but are the hardest to find. You know, they're not what the culture promotes. In a sense, what we are pursuing now are secondary satisfactions. Mm-hmm. Like I mentioned, wealth, power, material goods, and in its most shadowy ways, addiction. Those are all attempts to give us what it is that we are now missing. Those primary satisfactions are what satisfy us. And if we were given those things, the economy would collapse in a day.
Yeah, you know, as you're talking about this, this is one of the like little things like this that I noticed really changed in me when I was involved in that group, which was for, I think, maybe 5 years or something. I was mm-hmm. doing ritual with you, maybe longer. And I had, before I even entered the group, I was trying to practice voluntary simplicity,
mm-hmm.
best of my ability, and doing a pretty good job. But there were some things like, I just couldn't stop myself from filling up the bathtub with water, even though I didn't really need a full bathtub and had limited water where I lived. I just want to give that to myself. And I noticed after working with this group for a while, I could fill it up a third of the way and it was enough. You know, so many things out to be enough, actually more than enough, because I just was getting my satisfactions met in other areas. Yeah. Very important.
Yeah. I've said many times in ritual space that in this moment, no one wants to know what's on TV. Mm-hmm. No one wants to go out and buy a new car in this moment, because in this containment field, there's a sense of satisfaction.
Mm-hmm.
There is enough here to satisfy my soul.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we need to remember, particularly at this very delicate edge that we're walking.
Yeah, I can just remember being little. I mean, I think I was 10, 11 the first time I came to the Gratitude Weekend. And that was the, at least as far as like the bigger rituals, that was the ones that I was brought to. I think it was probably a wise decision maybe that I wasn't being brought to the grief rituals that were a little more intense for a 10-year-old to be at. But at the Gratitude Weekends, we would build these giant altars, shrines. I mean, we turned them into actual caves you could go into, but inside of a big hall, we would build these giant shrines out of all just found natural materials. Then people would bring special objects to place on them. But as a kid, doing that was so fun. It's all I wanted to do. I remember looking forward to those weekends kind of more than other holidays, because I was like, I get to build the thing. Like, I get to go and tramp through the woods and bring back whatever cool looking stick I think is going to be pretty to go on this thing. And just watching that get created. I mean, because we'll all share some photos, but it's pretty spectacular how big and full these things were. And it would just start an empty room, nothing in there. And then just these gorgeous shrines would emerge, and getting to see that happen from the help of, you know, many hands make light work. I think that was really one of the biggest lessons I've ever had in that, especially as a child, of seeing that community gather and make this beautiful something out of nothing, and getting to be a part of that, and was really, really amazing.
You did a beautiful job describing that process.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I mean, the creation of collective beauty, you know, I know, Sue Ellen, how much beauty is a part of your life. Just to collectively create beauty, I think, is so reparative to the soul. You know, we need to participate in beauty, but also beauty as the gateway to calling forth our deep gratitude, to say thank you, to recognize that we live in a gifting cosmos, and our sole responsibility in some ways as human beings is to say thank you. You know, those weekends were incredibly precious. We did that for 20 years before the pandemic hit, and just feeling that that rhythm being built up, you know, grief and gratitude. I often say that the mark of a mature human being is to have the capacity to carry grief to one hand and gratitude in the other, and to be stretched large by these two presences in our life. Mm-hmm. And so that was kind of the ritual calendar that we were following. Was, I don't know if we began in grief and ended in gratitude, or we began in gratitude and ended in grief. And in between, there are other rituals that we did. But that rhythm is part of what kept community inspired and fed. That's what we need also right now, is these rhythms of renewal, of repair, of healing, all the reasons why we consistently turn back to ritual as a primary practice, as a community.
One thing just had to come to mind as you were saying how important of a practice it is to say thank you. Part of your book that stood out to me, I've got it right here, is there was a section in there that was talking about, you were saying your wife, Judith, had asked, why work with grief? Like, why do this? And you'd pondered it a couple days and you came to her and said something along the lines of, because it's good manners to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And that just really, really struck me. And I think in the book as well, you then went on to say, like, manners is kind of an antiquated. Is that how you say that word?
Totally antiquated. Isn't. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Antiquated. Thank you. Tongue twister for me. Just such an antiquated idea nowadays of almost having manners means that you're rolling over, not standing up for yourself or in some weird way. And I think it's so not. And you're so right how important it is. And it's almost like having manners to just the earth and the world. And so I just feel like that kind of thank you comment goes hand in hand with that. So I don't know if you'd have more to say along that line.
No, it's a very good pickup there, Savannah, because manners, or we could call it the etiquette of living, requires a certain mutual and reciprocal relationship to the surrounding world. So manners is basically also an awareness of otherness. So I'm not just grasping what I can take. One of the core manners, I think, that I write about a lot and talk about a lot is restraint. Mm-hmm. This is not something we talk about in America. So you have it all. You can take what you want whenever you want. But restraint was a primary value in traditional cultures. You don't take too much, and you make sure the others, whether that's the animal others or the plant others, are being fed as well. So good manners means being aware of the kind of the complexity of relationships that we're in, that we're living within this matrix of intimacies, and all of them have to thrive or none of us will thrive. So these manners, restraint, reciprocity, humility, gratitude, those are all ethical, moral, soul practices to sustain living culture. So good pickup. It's a really good thread. Yeah.
And on like such a simpler frame of that, even just thinking about when you bump into someone in public, like literally bump into them, and they actually take a moment to step back and say like, oh, I'm sorry, I wasn't looking where I was going, versus how often do you brush shoulders with someone and they just kind of grunt at you and keep going. Those little moments mean so much nowadays. And I think it's because a lot of us have lost just those really simple baseline manners of telling another human being that they matter in some way.
Yeah, I think what we end up seeing is how few true adult human beings are walking around. Because in an adult body, there is this recognition of mutuality. There's this recognition of relationship. Mm-hmm. And so we know to practice those qualities of respect and mutuality rather than in. I remember writing once about how a mature human being is more aware of entanglements than entitlements, more aware of responsibilities than rights. Mm. And yet in America, it's all about rights and entitlements.
Yeah.
Don't don't infringe upon me. But that doesn't ever account for our entanglements, that we're mutually entangled, our welfare, our health, our survival, and my responsibilities. Yeah, I do. Yes, rights for sure. I'm not dismissing the rights, but we rarely talk about our mutual responsibilities. What are we obliged to take care of? You know, the streets have turned so cold and devoid of the warmth of what it is it's my responsibility to do, which is to try to tend to the generations that follow, to make sure the salmon keep running, do whatever I can on an individual basis to see if what we can do to keep things warm, keep things alive.
Yeah, that to me has always been, felt like the underpinnings of your work, Francis, is that you're thinking about what the young people are going to be walking into and the lives they're going to be living. And yeah, that be a good entry point to you bringing up this topic of the long dark and what means, and maybe, you know, the gifts that we might be able to find along that way there.
Yeah, this image or this metaphor of the long dark came a while back, just the idea of where we're heading collectively as a species. And we have entered what I call the long dark. This is a time of descent. We're going down.
Feels that way for sure.
Yeah. This is not a season of ascent and rising and confidence and
yeah,
I've got this. No, this is a season of descent, of into uncertainty, the unknown, into darkness, into grief. And fortunately, this is the dimension of soul. Mm-hmm. So we've been escorted into soul's terrain because we've been a very much of an ascension, spirit-oriented culture for a long time. Now we are going downward into soul's dimension. And that's where I think we can really learn so much from the nature of soul, its comfort in this territory. The long dark implies a different mode of engagement, more about listening, more about gestation and imagination, dreaming. We're not going to think our way through this crisis. We have all the information we need, right? I mean, we know all the data. We know how much CO2 is in the air. We've got it, but it's not doing something to us psychologically, soulfully. For that, I think, is this time of descent. And this is where our education changes from acquisition to letting go. In the old alchemical language, this darkness was called the negredo, the blackening. And the negredo was a season of dissolution. It was called the great dissolver. It's a time when things fall apart, break down, collapse, decay, and die. That can sound pretty ominous. But if we look at the collective image right now, some things must die. Some things must break down. I mean, capitalism is unsustainable. White supremacy is unsustainable. Gender biases are unsustainable. Economic disparities are unsustainable. These systems must break down. And we're seeing the beginnings of that. We're seeing certain, you know, patterns and paradigms that are promoting a very different way of being engaged with life on this earth. So the long dark feels like a time of quiet listening. There's a term in the Inuit tradition. Have you ever heard the term kartsaluni?
From you.
From me. Well, kartsaluni, I just love this idea, is a word that translates sitting quietly together in the dark, waiting expectantly for something creative to occur.
It says quite a bit about the Inuits that they have that word.
Isn't that true? I mean, and that's part of the manners, because that was about listening for the whale song. Mm-hmm. They couldn't go out and hunt until they got permission, and the permission came in the form of a song. So that's profound manners. We just don't go out and grab it because we need it. You wait out of respect to receive the gift of that sacrifice, of one of them saying, you may have my body. So that's profound respect. That's an etiquette of restraint and also of reverence. So in the long dark, which will probably last potentially several generations. So Ellen, you and I will not see the end of the long dark. We will not make it to that far horizon. But as we talked about before we started recording, this is a time of throwing seed. Mm-hmm. This is a time when we have to hold the long vision in the long dark, that perhaps we don't, I mean, there's no guarantee right now, is there, that the species will make it. But what if we do? What will be the founding principles of a living culture? And how do we seed that now in terms of ritual practices, in terms of manners, in terms of primary satisfactions, in terms of knowing how to hold one another through some very difficult times? because the season ahead will be undoubtedly difficult.
Mm-hmm. As I've gone through my life, I've often thought, you know, just like when I was at work, I'd say things like, why don't we develop childcare here at work so we can bring our babies with us and we don't have to have this severing of... And people would say things like, well, everything's got to change. If we did that, everything would have to change. And I always thought, well, maybe everything does need to change. And so now here we are, where everything seems to be unraveling and falling apart.
Yeah.
I just wasn't quite ready for it anyway, though, even though I want to hold the vision of a positive outcome.
Yeah, we certainly have to hold that vision that we are within us. I mean, I always go back to this idea of Jung's. We talked about that each of us carries what he called the unforgotten wisdom that resides at the core of the psyche, that somehow in the shaping of our own psychic lives over that long period of time, these things got embedded in us. Mm-hmm. So like when we do ritual, some part of us recognizes, oh, this is familiar,
right.
even if we've never done it before.
Right.
So there's a part of what we call the archaic psyche that recognizes all of the primal patterns mm-hmm. for how to do this. And so what we're trying to do is what I call remembering forward. Mm-hmm. So we can't just keep this obsessional movement of progress. Progress has gotten us to this edge right now. What we do need to do is reach back and recall those primal practices that we can carry forward into the current time. As we know, Paul Shepherd said that we can't go back because we never left. Mm-hmm. We are still those primal creatures. We're still Pleistocene-aged creatures that know about ritual and art and community and, you know, relationships of grandeur with the surrounding fields of animals and ancestors and spirits and place. Mm-hmm. We're not without the tools to respond to this time, but we need to you know, find out the skill sets that go with the long dark. And that's not something that we're taught any place collectively in this culture, or rarely, I should say, not any place.
Well, and that brings me to all your work with grief. Mm. I thought about that so much. And it was another reason why I was drawn to you initially, Frances, and your work. And I thought, you know, I remember the first grief ritual I went to that you had called for. I don't even know how, it was a long time ago. And I thought, who's going to go to this thing?
Right.
And it was packed. This little room, which I'm so glad I knew you back in the days when it was relatively small venues. This little room was packed with people that wanted to grieve, that needed to grieve, that were so tired of carrying it alone. And I've thought about that, our whole shame in this culture and our resistance to grief. Do you think that that's an ancestral thing that we carry, Frances, around because we were on the run or something, that we didn't have time to grieve, so we had to hide it? Have you ever had any thoughts about
I mean, the more I sit with grief, and it's been many decades now, the more I feel that almost all of our grief is ancestral.
Uh-huh.
Even if I carry, you know, my wound with shame in this lifetime, and I go, well, that's my shame. Well, it didn't begin with me. What were the? Where did this come from? What was the originating time where this pattern of relating to one another, where did that come from? So much of what we carry is not a personal, nor is it contemporary. It is, as Rumi would say, it began in some other tavern. It began a long time ago. And so we're the current curators of this grief. It's up to us to metabolize it and work with it and understand what happens when we do that to the heart, to the soul, and to that sense of relatedness that comes with grief work. But yes, I think so much of the grief we carry is generations and generations old, a lot of it having to do with rupture and disruption and trauma.
That wanting to hide it, that impulse to hide our grief. And yet, as I know from working in all these groups with you, I think it was the first time I actually realized it at my mother's funeral when I saw my dad cry. But when somebody does break down into tears, it's such a relief.
Yes.
Yeah. It's so softening. Everybody's hearts soften and we're connected then, right?
And you bring up an important point, which is that what is it that signals to the psyche that it's time to grieve? Mm. And so when the ritual practices began to dissipate and the church came in and, you know, kind of created more sedate practices of of grief, the signal to the psyche was basically to contain it, to hold it, because the signal frequency of the deep radical ritual was not being given. So the psyche wisely just becomes a containment field. And so we, again, have generations of material that has not been wept over. The disruption of land bases, of languages, of ritual practices, of food, of being where your ancestors were buried. I mean, so much disruption happened along this way for us. Do you have something, Sue Ellen?
Yeah, I did. I was wondering if we could pull that apart a little bit, the difference between ceremony and ritual, the shift from ritual to ceremony.
Well, it's helpful for me to imagine it this way. I know many people do not. But for me, ceremony is more the cultural reinforcing practices. Mm-hmm. Like I was raised Catholic and we went to Mass, you know, every Sunday, but I don't think I ever came out of Mass changed. Mm-hmm. I felt reconnected. You know, we gave each other the sign of peace and we were singing together. It was beautiful. You know, I loved parts of it, especially when it was in Latin. But
you didn't imagine.
Yeah. But you didn't necessarily come out of the church service altered. Ritual, on the other hand, is what I call the vertical axis. And this is the dimension in which the human being can feel itself deranged. You come into ritual with the hope that what you encounter in that space will shake you, will rearrange you in some fashion. I don't want to come out of ritual the same as I went in. And we need both. We need the ceremonial to reinforce the bonds of relatedness between the community members. And we also need this access because we need to be rearranged periodically because the current arrangement is often not working. So derangement becomes a necessity. Problem is with ritual is that it scares the crap out of us, particularly if we're not familiar with it. So few of us in white culture are familiar with that feeling of derangement. Our job is to always be in control. I'm supposed to always be monitoring what I express, how I express it, the intensity with which I express it. And if I do too much, I end up apologizing. And then comes the shame. I was out of control. Oh my God. I lost control today. I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to cry.
I showed my underbelly.
I showed my weakness. I showed my fear. I showed my grief. Mm-hmm. And those are things in a heroic culture when the idea is control and perfection and strength. Those things don't really find a space to be expressed. And that's the beauty, I think, of these rituals is that we are given permission to fall to our knees, to have snot blowing out of our nose and, you know, not worry about covering it up and to feel side by side your kin also in the same posture, expressing the same degree of their own grief and pain and loss. That is so healing. That itself is so healing. Mm-hmm. To not be isolated and alone. I often joke that, yeah, we go to a private practice to talk about the private matters of our private grief. And that's not what the psyche wants. I'll say to people in my practice, this is a good place to learn to tolerate contact with your grief. But ultimately, you need a larger holding space for the full measure of that release to happen. You cannot do that in private. It just doesn't work. That's not how we're shaped. Mm-hmm. We need two things to set grief down. One is containment and one is release. And if I'm doing it all by myself, I never get to the release phase.
Interesting.
I'm a constant containment field. And what I call, we end up recycling grief. Mm-hmm. So we chew the same bones over and over and over again. And we never, in a sense, get current. We never get to really be living in this current moment or to feel the electricity of aliveness. And it's another part of what I love about grief work is that if you do it enough, eventually you begin to feel like I'm living now. I'm not always facing the U-Haul of my life, you know, all of the stuff that I'm dragging behind me, both mine, my ancestors, my culture, my planet, it's always there.
The U-Haul of my life. I love that.
Yeah.
So all of this is making me think I have a paragraph of your book here that I underlined and like exclamation pointed a bunch. And it goes along with kind of the breaking into this and stepping into ritual the first time and this containment that we have and how hard it is to crack it open. So if it's okay, I'm going to read a little passage here. It's from the chapter Pushing Through Solid Rock. And you write, I remember the difficulty I faced when I attended my first grief ritual. I watched as dozens of men and women fell to their knees, weeping and expressing their sorrow. I could not touch my grief, could not coax it to the surface and onto the ground. I stood there numb, frightened by the raw display of suffering. It wasn't until I participated in my third grief ritual that I was able to release my tears, which I just have to say is like such a good reminder to people to keep doing the thing, and that it's not always just a one. It takes time. You go on saying, I needed to keep going, needed to be near the energy of sorrow. I couldn't run away because I was aware that I had a reservoir of grief in my body, but lacked the means of freeing it. I realize now how frozen I was, how disconnected I had become from my emotional body. Learning to befriend this vulnerable piece of my soul has in turn opened the way to experiencing a much wider array of emotions. Joy, love, anger, sadness, delight, amazement, the entire range of my emotional landscape. And I think that's just such a good point that, like, when we contain one, we're containing all of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an integrated system. We can't say, well, I'll just keep joy and we'll shelve the sorrow for now. And it just doesn't work that way. You know, we live in what I wrote about as a flatline culture. There's a very, very narrow band of what it is we're allowed to express and feel. And outside of that, it's kind of a numbed zone. So we don't have joy in the culture. We have excitement. We have stimulation, you know, but rare to see true joy being expressed. And I'm sure it does happen. I pray it keeps happening. But for the most part, when we abandon that lower register of grief, the top register of joy collapsed.
Well, and I love using that word derangement as a positive word, because you hear deranged and you're like, oh no, got to stay away from that. But taking that as like such a beautiful thing and saying, well, if we can derange ourselves into getting out of this narrow path that we're on and maybe actually start to feel more of all the things. Mm. Oh my God, I still want to be deranged.
I hope so.
Sounds amazing.
Said the girl with pink hair.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. And I have to say, Frances, that you're an excellent example of that, because I was always so tickled by going through these grief rituals with you. And then you would be so funny. We'd end with a big celebratory dinner. And you were always so funny and so fun. In fact, the whole group was. It was like once you allow yourself to bottom out like that, get down to the bottom, then there's just so much energy that's released.
Right, right. Yeah. Our typical projection onto grief is that it's a deadening zone. Mm-hmm. And it's not. It's incredibly alive. Mm-hmm. It's incredibly vital. I remember my friend once asked me, we were driving back from a men's conference, and he said, so Frances, are you happy? I said, I have moments of being happy, but I said, I'm not trying to be happy anymore. I'm trying to be alive. And that every emotion has vitality in it. My grief has vitality, my sadness, my anger, even my loneliness, there's vitality in it. And we've been so singularly focused on happiness that we have missed aliveness. So as I've been more open to grief and all these other emotional territories, my sense of aliveness has absolutely increased. And, you know, rather than walking through the world deadened, it's not easy, right? Being with all of these emotions, it's not easy, but it's alive. And I think that's our obligation to our life individually, but also to our collective life, is to be as alive as possible. I want to follow one more thread, can I?
Yes, please.
The piece you wrote, I read, Savannah, about how hard it was to get to grief. That was so instructive for me about what we need, particularly white culture needs, to loosen up the hard pan, the very packed grief that we carry. It's hard to just walk into a space and start grieving. Mm-hmm. So we began bringing different practices in, writing practice, movement, song. I began looking at how do we loosen up that hard pack so that the tributaries of grief can find little fissures in the ground and come back out again. And that's what I've been doing, like I say, for the last 25 years, is really experimenting with patterns and practices that allow us to get, by the time we get to the ritual, a good chance that we're going to be able to weep together.
I'm wondering if you feel like creativity, like your writing, is part of what helps you to nurture that aliveness. You know, you have the experience and then you give this gift.
I think, Blake was very clear. William Blake was very clear that, you know, our spiritual life, our soulful life is totally entangled with our creativity, you know, and that if we don't have a form of expression, because the soul came here for full expression. Mm-hmm. So finding dance or painting like you do, or you know, writing for me, or poetry, sculpting, whatever it is, give it some form of expression to keep it moving. I think a lot of our grief is from, not so much from, you know, people come and say, I'm depressed. I said, no, you're oppressed. You're living with a sediment of grief that hasn't been expressed. So that's why when we're doing our grief ritual weekends, it comes through all these different creative practices, giving form, giving expression to what oftentimes has not been expressed.
I have another quote underlined right here in front of me that I just have to say, because I feel like, again, it's like right there. This is you referencing a conversation you were having with somebody who'd been in practice with you. And then they were asking about the idea of goals and a goal of getting out of depression, perhaps. And your response was, one of the deepest sources of depression for the soul is a diminished range of participation in our own life. So to be fully alive would be the goal. And I think that's just such a good sentence to go along with everything you've just been saying of it's not that we're depressed because of something that we're doing to ourselves, potentially because we're not doing.
Right. I was on a Symington Cancer Conference a few years ago, and I was the last speaker. The speaker before me was Nina Wise. I don't know. Do you know Nina Wise?
I don't know her.
Oh, amazing human being. She puts on these one-woman shows frequently, and she did that right before my talk. She did a one-woman extemporaneous play about her cancer journey, and it was amazing.
Will you say her name again?
Nina Wise, Wise. And I had to get up on stage after that. I said, yeah, but one of the things she said that really touched me was, as an artist, as a creative human being, she has spent a lifetime trying to address this question of how little we are encouraged to express ourselves. And that so much of our depression is related to the silencing of our expression. We're told we can't sing. Well, you don't write very well. You'll never be a poet, you know, and best you leave the dancing to the professionals. And, you know, everything becomes something that we are not entitled to participate in. Mm-hmm. So giving expression, finding ways to give soul its opportunity for that greater participation, that quote you just read of mine, Savannah, that's what it's yearning for. The soul came here for full participation, and how rare it is that we grant that scope of engagement. It's usually kind of diminished to survival or earning a living, which is one of the most obscene sentences in Western culture, that I have to earn a living, rather than having living be something that is just intrinsic to my being in this body. So we could go on about that. But
mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel like my brain is exploding. Actually, thinking of that is so ridiculous. And that's what we're told from the time we're in middle school, is being like, okay, all of this is to earn a living.
That's right. That's right. To become part of the machinery of capitalism. But again, that is such a diminished sentence for what was meant to be a life of grandeur. Mm-hmm. A sense of, if you compare that with the, you know, the images on the cave walls of like Lascaux, though, you know, just living in grandeur is our inheritance, to know relationships of magnitude with the stars and the moon and the woods, and everything is open to relationship, and we are reduced to a paycheck and a portfolio. And
that's so disempowering. And it's
so,
I think it's part of why Americans end up putting up with so much bullshit from the politicians. Is just, we're not grounded. And I'm thinking, you know, as you were talking about the grief and the ritual, I felt so supported, so much more supported since I started working with my grief in that way, and so much more rooted in the world.
Right.
It's easier to stand up and say, no, this isn't right.
Yeah. I wrote about the third gate of grief, you know, the sorrows of the world. Mm. And the more we stay, again, current with our grief, the more, in a sense, we fall in love with the world, because the heart is not closed and frozen out of not being able to express that grief. So the more that we are able to feel it, I often say at the end of the grief rituals, as we're doing our closing prayer, we didn't do this for ourselves only. We did this so that our hearts can walk out into the streets again, open and generous, and able to love those that we meet, and able to care for and protect what is vulnerable at this time. So it may be the broken heart that saves our ass right now. It may be that grief is the one thing that can penetrate deep enough to remind us that we are grieving because of love. We are grieving because of what we love, and what we love is being harmed. And we need to be able to feel that and be willing to feel that, you know, and have the courage to feel that. But it's so hard to do that in isolation. That's why it's so valuable to do what we're doing right now, is, you know, and to gather in community and just to acknowledge the weight that's on everyone's heart right now. There's not a single person that you meet on the street that is not carrying a load of sorrow, but we just don't have places to take it now.
Francis, this is bringing up a question for me. You know, I live in this little rural community, and we do have different groups that we have a death cafe that meets, and they were asking for a grief ritual, which we recently held. And I think maybe 20 people turned up. It was a good amount for the size of this community.
Mm-hmm.
Not one man came. Mm-hmm. They come to the death cafe, but they didn't come to this ritual. And I was wondering if you had any insight as to how to encourage men, because I just know, having raised a boy myself, the huge injunction that's put on men in this culture to hide their tears.
Oh, absolutely. I think one of the ways that I've dealt with that is to have gatherings of men only. Mm-hmm. I know when I was doing the men's initiation work, the amount of grief men carry for their loneliness is astronomical. Mm-hmm. I have not met a man who feels like he's been able to just, you know, simply exist in the world and feel supported. That's that heroic archetype that kind of is placed on the head of every man is one of, you know, rising again, success, control, power, achievement, accomplishment, success, success, success. And getting a man to show up for a grief ritual is challenging based on that conditioning. It's really, really hard. So creating spaces where there was only men, and we began to talk about, in honesty, what it's been like to be conditioned as a man in white culture, just how deprived we are of the right to grieve and to hold each other. You know, the forbiddenness of even just touching one another. So the loneliness of the male body is extraordinary. I am encouraged by how many more men are showing up over the years.
Well, in your groups, yes. And I have to say, just having experienced witnessing men who started with your group and then seeing them 10 years later, they're like, they're these love monsters. Really wonderful. You know, they'll start off kind of prickly and uptight, and then they turn into these beautiful creatures. Yeah, I so love that you're doing that work, but there aren't that many of you around. So I don't know, but I hear you. And I think that that's a good suggestion to make it a men's only grief ritual. Yeah,
and just keep repeating. I mean, I don't know how often you're thinking of holding your grief circles, but if you even did them quarterly, my guess is that men will start to trickle in.
Okay.
Because I think there's a hunger. I once wrote an article called The Necessity of Defeat, how no man had ever stepped into my office voluntarily. He came in because of an addiction, a divorce, the loss of a job, an illness, the death of someone close. He stumbled across the threshold. He didn't, hey, I'm here for me. That's not why they're there. They were there because of defeat. Mm-hmm. And with defeat in a heroic culture comes shame. So it's, again, one of those catch-22s of, God, I need a place to grieve. I need a place to be held. I can't go. You know, it's too much shame for feeling defeat, for feeling loss, for feeling out of control. But in those settings in which it was just men talking about this with other men, the grief was deep and prolonged. Yeah, it's a sustained note in a man's body.
So
all bodies, I'm sure. I know all bodies, all genders carry their own grief, and we need places to be held.
So, I mean, aside from me recommending every single person who's listening read your book and start to put some of those practices into play, do you have any suggestions for people who, you know, haven't built community before but are craving that, and how they can start and don't consider themselves to be therapists or leaders or whatever it is. And
oh, absolutely. I mean, if we're waiting for professionals to do this, we're screwed.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not going to happen. I mean, we just did a rich grief ritual training online and we had 750 people from 30 countries.
Oh, that's incredible.
It was incredible. It was incredible. And that question came up, well, do I need to be a licensed therapist to do this? And I said, if that's the case, forgive my language, I said, we're fucked. If we're going to rely upon this little cast of people, this is the most ordinary thing there is. What's more ordinary than grief? You know, this is the commons of the soul, but this speaks to the amnesia. This speaks to the great forgetting. We've forgotten how to be with each other in this inevitable encounter with sorrow. So the idea here is to keep it small and keep it simple. I mean, everyone I'm hoping is listening to this has maybe at least one or two friends, and to invite them over on any given night and say that the topic tonight is loss. And let's just make some agreements. The first agreement is that we're not going to try to fix anybody. Mm-hmm. That grief is not a problem to be solved. It's a presence awaiting witnessing. And so we're here simply to witness each other's grief. So maybe we make a little, read a poem or say a prayer or light a candle or whatever to create ritual. But it can be so utterly simple and so utterly basic of just hearing the stories that need to be told and letting the tears come, letting them fall. This other thought just came in. I want to acknowledge that grief is not simply tears. It's also outrage. That our grief is also our protest about what is happening, whether it's in Gaza or to our watersheds, you know, wherever the injustice is happening, there's grief. And it's not just tears. It's also my protest. It's my outrage about what is happening. Because outrage is also connected to my heart's experience of loss and suffering. I just wanted to bring that in there too, that there's place, some people come to grief through their outrage, but since it's not associated with grief, they can't express it. So we make lots of space in our grief rituals for outrage, mm-hmm. protest. Yeah.
Thank you for that. So important. And I've definitely noticed a connection with outrage and grief when I find myself really breaking down into tears, and then I'll look underneath it and it's outrage about some injustice that's gone on in the world that
right.
I've become numb to, and I don't want to be numb. I want to be alive like you're talking about.
That means staying current with the sorrow. Yeah.
So I think one thing, I mean, at least that I've felt myself and that I've heard people talk about, and I think is mentioned in your book too, is people's resistance to this work, because there's a feeling of being like, well, if I open it up, the floodgates are open. Am I going to drown? Am I ever going to be able to get back out of it? I'm just going to be flailing in this space because I've kept it closed for so long. I'm just terrified of opening it.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just wondering if you have any suggestions of, like, if this is a space that's being held of people who are just people, and if there's any suggestions on how to close a moment of that, and ways to help people feel like they're not coming and sharing these really intimate experiences and then leaving the house with an open wound that's going to be bleeding all over everything for the rest of however long until you come and meet again, you know?
right. Yeah, it's a good question, because it speaks back to our lack of faith in grief. It's a sense that we fear that we're going to be taken hostage. That if I open that door, people, I mean, I can't tell you how many times in my practice I've heard someone say, if I go there, I'm never coming back. Mm. And what I end up saying to them, I said, if you don't go there, you're never coming back.
Mm.
Because so much of our psychic energies is devoted to maintaining that cap, keeping it closed off, keeping it shut down. So we're not living, we're surviving. And again, no judgment there. Thank God you're surviving. But that's not, again, what the soul came here for. So how do we, again, reacquaint them? And so I talk a lot about titration, just slowly. So we'll write in our weekends, we'll write for 10 minutes. And that gives the person a chance to step into it and step out. Mm-hmm. You're beginning to build a rhythm of contact and separation. This isn't, you know, again, building some muscle so we can once again have faith that I can be in relationship with this. Mm-hmm. And there's a whole thing, there's an essay I wrote called An Apprenticeship with Sorrow. And I talk about these six practices that help us with this apprenticeship. And the first one is coming into right relationship with grief. So we either push it away or we end up drowning in it. But what we could imagine is walking alongside it like a companion, that I'm going to be in a constant relationship to this energy. It's never going to go away, even if 95% of it's not personal, I am still going to be feeling the grief of the world, grief of the ancestors. I'm going to be feeling that it's going to be with me forever. So it's wise for me to develop an apprenticeship, learning how to be in relationship with this energy. The second thing is to have a practice, whether it's meditation or prayer or writing or dancing or knitting or whatever it is. What do you rely upon to steady yourself when the winds are strong? Because we're all going to encounter big losses in our life. Every one of us. It may be us that's disappearing. But we all know that the storms will come. So how do we prepare for that? The third, should we go on with this?
Yeah, if you don't mind. Yeah. I think this is a great way to close this out.
The third part of the apprenticeship is coming into adult presence. This is such a big topic. We could spend 3 days talking about this one idea. This comes from an experiment that Jung did decades and decades ago, where he began to see what he called complexes, small fragments of psychological life that had been fragmented off because they were not adequately held. Traumas, basically. We call that post-traumatic stress or whatever. In grief, very few of us as children had our grief adequately held, so it didn't feel like it had a bottom. So when grief comes up typically, and I've seen this many times in workshops or in my office, suddenly there's this face of a terrified three-year-old that has just come into the room and looking for the exit and really scared. And until I can get them back into an adult presence, nothing's going to happen because that child is not capable of grieving. That child's part of us is capable of survival, but no more, you know, and there's no imagination in this place. So our job is to separate from that and to migrate the grief into the adult's hands over time so that the adult is now the one responding when grief comes up. That person, the adult, has the range and the capacity to process the grief.
I'm so glad you brought this up because that other giant paragraph I like underlined five was about so much we're told, at least the messages I'm getting is like, go back to your child self, you know, like reconnect with your child. And like, all of that's so good, but there is a feeling.
Yeah, I'm much more concerned about reconnecting with my adult self. So I have the capacity to address those other parts that come up. The fourth one is silence and solitude. And even though I talk a lot about community, the vast majority of our time with grief will be alone. So how can I cultivate an interior atmosphere of silence and solitude rather than isolation and loneliness? And I tell the story in the book of a woman I was working with, and she came into my office one day and just said, I just hate going home at night. I said, why is that? She said, well, she was going through a pretty bad divorce. So I get home and I'm all alone. It's cold, it's dark, and I just feel so lonely when I walk in the door. I said, well, can you imagine this as the holiest time of day? And when you walk in the door, you're greeting the most vulnerable part of you. And could you greet this part and say, let's put the tea on. Let's warm up some soup. I'll start the fire. Tell me about your day. I'll tell you about mine. And then I remembered this little line from Rilke, Rainer Maria Rilke, where he said, I am too alone in the world, but not alone enough to make every moment holy. What a beautiful pivot he makes, right? From isolation to the sanctuary of solitude, and how rare we do that, you know? The next one is self-compassion, that this is kind of the keynote of a soulful life, is learning how to welcome all that's been outcast, all that's been harmed, all the harm that we've done, just learning how to hold that all with a generous heart. And one of the ways I define self-compassion is the internalized community. How would my friends hold me right now when I could be quick to self-judgment, self-blame? How would my friends in this moment hold my suffering? And they're much more generous than I am towards me. So that's where I practice self-compassion, is remembering my entanglements, which leads to the sixth practice, which is to remember our entanglements. I was going to bed once, 2020 in the fall, just before the election, and I was full of despair. I was not looking forward to this election, figuring the results would be pretty horrendous. And I was just about to get into bed when something literally turned my body around and walked me to a bookshelf. And I reached out onto the shelf and I pulled down this book by Linda Hogan, who's a Chickasaw poet and writer. And the book was a collection of her essays called Dwellings. And I opened the book to the chapter, All My Relations. And I realized in that moment I had forgotten them all. My despair was a consequence of my isolation and my disconnection. And so I began to extend out my filaments of connection and remembrance to star clusters and moon and turtle and salamander and and the despair just began to dissipate instantly. So the apprenticeship is, in the old language, would lead to someone becoming a master after you've practiced and dedicated your life to carpentry or painting or weaving or stonemasonry. You'd be called a master, craftsperson. In the work of soul and the apprenticeship with sorrow, it doesn't lead to mastery, it leads to elderhood. An elder is someone who has metabolized enough sorrow in their lifetime that they don't run away from it anymore, and that they accept life on life's terms, and they see it as their responsibility to keep engendering life wherever they can, and to respond to sorrows and suffering wherever they can and whenever they can. So that's the work of the apprenticeship, is crafting of elders.
Thank you so much.
Well, pleasure to be with both of you. So good to see you.
Yeah, it's good to see you too.
Lovely.
So if we can take just another minute or two of your time, we like to wrap up each of our episodes with what we call a little gift. So just sharing something that's been a little gift from the universe to you. It can be big or small, but I think it's just a really nice way to, you know, tie things in and end on a note of joy, if you will.
Sure. I think it's 2 weeks ago now, 3 weeks. I was in Salt Lake City leading a grief ritual, possibly my last one. Mm-hmm. And after the ritual was over, the two people who were hosting us drove us down to southern Utah, to Boulder, Utah. Never been there. It was so gorgeous. It was so beautiful. And one place they took us was a place called Singing Canyon. And it's one of those very narrow, you know, carved, full of red, orange sculpture of sandstone, I think. And we brought drums and we sat in there and we just sang and drummed and felt the beauty and the majesty of that place and our connection to one another. And that was one of those primary satisfactions, absolutely being fully met and celebrated.
Mm-hmm. So, oh, beautiful.
Yeah. It was. It was so beautiful.
I love those moments. And my little gift just happened yesterday. I mean, I've had lots of little gifts recently, but I was flying, one of my least favorite things, from Oakland to Salt Lake City, of all places.
Ah, uh-huh.
And a passenger, the person that I was sitting beside, was this young man, Jason Stevens is his name. And it was just so fun meeting a whole new friend. And we had deep philosophical conversations from the moment we sat down till the time the plane landed. And he wrote me a little note this morning, which was so sweet. Thanks for the conversation. And I just think those moments when we can really, you know, touch one another's hearts spontaneously, like that, unexpected, it's so meaningful and wonderful. So thank you, Jason.
Thank you, Jason.
So mine will be on Monday. I'm sure, as everybody's aware of at this point, we had that solar eclipse happening, and one of my dear friends and coworkers was hosting a breath workshop, and I was just, at first I was like really excited to go, and then I got home and I was like, oh man, I'm really gonna leave the house again, I don't know about this. But with it being the eclipse and all the things, I was like, okay, no, I should go. Today's a good day to do something like that. And I went, and it was just an incredibly sweet experience. And it's just the simplest thing in the world. But halfway through the workshop, I was really cold. And my normal tendency is to just kind of be like, well, it's called work for a reason, you know, just suffer through it. You know, there's progress on the other side of pain. Which I know is just such an absurd thing to think, because I would never put that on anybody else, but with myself, you know, how we do. But I stopped myself and I just raised my hand and asked her to bring me a blanket. And she brought me the blanket, because of course she would. And I was warm and it was fine and everything went well. And, you know, I didn't ruin my experience because I paused and asked for a human basic need. In fact, I made it better. And it was just such, again, a small, simple thing that felt so profoundly huge. And yeah, so that was mine. I asked for a blanket and everything was okay.
I love it. I love it. Yeah, beautiful.
Yeah. Well, before we hop off, Frances, is there ways people can find you if they are interested in your work? Obviously, there's your books, But how else would you suggest people find their way to you?
The easiest way is my website, franciswellar.net. That's where all the, I mean, right now I'm on a sabbatical. I'm not doing any workshops, but there's a listing of all of my, all the people who study with me. If they're offering a grief ritual, they're all listed there. So, and they're happening all across the country in Australia. And so all over the place. So, if you're looking for rituals, you can probably find one not too far from where you are. Mm-hmm. And there's also all the other audio programs that I've done over the years. And
Thank you. So it's not under Wisdom Edge anymore. It's now it's Francis Weller.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, good. Good to know. Yeah.
Well, thank you so, so much. This has been such a delight to talk to you and reconnect. And
it's been absolutely a pleasure for me too.
Yeah.
Good to see you both. Give my love to Mira.
And give my love to Judith. I'd love to see her.
Happy to do that too. Yeah, I will.
Oh, all right. Well, I love you, Grandma.
I love you, Savannah.
We love you, listeners.
We love you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. We'll talk to you next week.
Okay. Bye.
If you enjoy this show, and I'll assume you do since you're listening, please rate and review us on Apple and Spotify. It would also be amazing if you could tell your friends and family about it. Word of mouth recommendations are the best marketing a podcast could wish for. To keep in touch, you can find us on Instagram at Little Gifts Podcast, or you can send us a note at littlegiftspodcast@gmail.com. Every love note we get makes our day. And if you feel inspired to share, we would be so excited to hear about the little gifts that have shown up in all of your lives. To see or purchase Sue Ellen's artwork, you can find her on Facebook and Instagram at sue.ellen.parkinson. You can also visit her website at sueellenparkinson.com. Our music is by the talented musician Robin O'Brien. Big thanks to Robin. Please subscribe to our show and go ahead and leave us that review while you're at it. Thanks again, and we'll be back next week. Thank you.